This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
First question this month is from Rupen, and he says, I've located a star that seems to be flickering several colours in an odd way. The star's called Canopus, but I'd like to know why it flickers and why in different colours. And he also says, P.S., you guys rock. So thanks for that, Rupen. Actually, so what you're talking about is twinkling. So if you look at stars in the sky, particularly stars that are quite low down, they often seem to twinkle, bright stars low down, you know, not far above the horizon. And it's actually caused by the atmosphere, which is why the ones that are lower down are affected most, because the light from the stars passing through more atmosphere. And it's basically just due to turbulence. So the atmosphere is not completely steady. And on a bad night, there's a lot of motion of different cells, we call them, different sort of patches of air in the atmosphere that are of different densities. And as the light, as the rays of light from the star pass through them, then they get refracted, so they get bent through these regions of dense and less dense air. So the path of the light is constantly changing as these turbulent cells move about in the atmosphere. And so we see the brightness of the star changing rapidly, which is what you call twinkling. Now, because this refraction is actually an effect that changes with wavelength, so the angles through which the light is bent changes depending on the wavelength of light, then you actually see the colours affected differently. So the star can actually change in brightness rapidly and change in colour rapidly, because the blue light's taking a slightly different path to the red light, for example. And the effect, this twinkling effect, is actually less pronounced for planets. So if you happen, for example, to look at the planet Jupiter, which is bright at the moment, then you tend to see less of an effect, because the planet itself is a sort of disk. It's not a point-like object. So if you can imagine the sort of disk of the planet, then you get the twinkling effect at different points on the disk, but it sort of averages out over the disk. So you don't notice it twinkling as much when you look up with your eyes. So we call this seeing. So if the seeing is good, you see a nice steady point of light for the star. If it's bad, then you see this sort of twinkling, and that would mean the images, you know, they're dancing about all the time. You get a very blurred view. Now, we can actually attempt to correct for this with modern telescopes, with what we call adaptive optics. So the VLT, for example, the Very Large Telescope in Chile, actually has a system where, after the main big mirror, the 8-meter mirror, there are several other mirrors in the light path, and you can actually take one of these smaller mirrors and you can deform it, you can change its shape very rapidly in real time to attempt to correct for this sort of dancing about of the image due to the turbulence. It's actually a bit easier if you do this at slightly longer wavelengths than the visible light, so somewhere in the near part of the infrared, because the size of the stable patches in the atmosphere is actually larger at these longer wavelengths. Now, in order to do this correction, you actually need quite a bright star, because you need quite a lot of light coming through in order to sort of for the signal from the star to dominate over the noise. So because most stars are not that bright, or that there's not very bright stars near the objects that we're interested in looking at, we can actually make artificial stars. And in this case, we use a laser, shine it up into the atmosphere. We can excite sodium atoms in a layer in the atmosphere about 90 kilometers above the ground. That produces this sort of, when you excite them, you put energy into these sodium atoms, they then glow. So you basically produce an artificial star close enough to to the actual star or the object you're interested in making an image of, that the light from it passes through the same turbulent regions of the atmosphere. And so you can use observations of the artificial star to correct for the turbulence and sharpen up the image of your target. Okay, the next question is from Matthew Hyman. And Matthew says, in the last Jodcast, I answered a question about the Milky Way colliding in the future with the Andromeda galaxy. And he's wondering why, if everything goes out from a central point, the Big Bang, how can two galaxies actually crash into one another? Is one galaxy moving out slower than the other? And he also says thanks and great work. So thank you for that, Matthew. Well, the answer here really is that when galaxies are close together, so like the Milky Way being relatively close to Andromeda, the force of gravity between these two galaxies, between us and Andromeda, is actually strong enough to overcome the expansion of the universe. So actually galaxies in groups or clusters are actually sort of orbiting one another in this group. The gravity is overcoming the expansion of the universe. And they can actually crash into each other, just like the Milky Way and Andromeda are coming together. So what people should really be doing when people talk about the expanding universe and they say things like all the galaxies are moving away from each other, they should really be a little bit more careful, and they should say that clusters of galaxies are all moving away from each other rather than individual galaxies moving away from each other. And that would be then accurate. And so I think that probably gets around your whole problem. It's not that every single galaxy is moving away from every single other galaxy. It's that clusters of galaxies are moving away from other clusters of galaxies. Next question this month is from Philip Jones, and he's asking about black holes. He says, can I please explain how black holes lose energy by radiation, and how does this form a jet of particles? Surely if it's a black hole, then nothing can escape from it. And also, if these particles are formed from vacuum energy, how come they form a jet and they're not present all the way around the event horizon? Okay, so there's really a bit of confusion here, actually, because there's two different things involved. You're right, Philip, nothing can escape a black hole event horizon. If something passes in through the event horizon of a black hole, it can't get back out again unless it was somehow able to travel faster than the speed of light. And as we know, nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. So I think this arises, again, from perhaps people not being careful enough in their terminology. And when they talk about jets coming from black holes, they're talking about them coming from near the black hole, or perhaps from the region around the black hole, not from inside the black hole itself. Now, these particles you're talking about that are formed from vacuum energy, that's called Hawking radiation. And that's a quantum effect where photons or other particles might radiate from the event horizon itself of extremely small black holes. So where some of the particles or photons would fall into the black hole, others radiate away. And that actually does lead to the energy and the mass of those tiny black holes reducing, and an event is called black hole evaporation, where the black hole eventually disappears. And that effect, although predicted, hasn't yet been directly observed. Now, when you talk about jets coming from black holes, remember we should say jets coming from the regions around black holes. Well, yeah, this is a really commonly observed phenomenon. And in fact, it's one of the earliest discoveries, really, in radio astronomy. And when we first had radio telescopes back in the 1940s and 50s, we sort of mapped the radio sky and we found these very bright sources of radio waves. They called them radio stars because they sort of, you know, looked a bit like point sources, a bit like stars in the radio sky. And one of them, for example, is called Cygnus A. It's one of the brightest radio objects in the skies in the constellation of Cygnus. Looked like a bright spot of radio waves. And by studying that in greater detail, there was found to be a spot of, you know, there was a sort of blurry blob of visible light in roughly the same direction. But the problem was that because the radio waves are so much longer than visible light, you get a much more blurred image in the radio. So it was really hard to tell, you know, which object the radio source was actually associated with in a visible image. So what we needed to do, what was developed at the time, was this technique of interferometry, where instead of taking one telescope or one aerial that's picking up the radio waves, you take two aerials and you separate them by larger and larger distances. And that lets you effectively zoom in, lets you study smaller and smaller, tinier and tinier details in the radio sky. And at Jodrell Bank in the 1950s, there were two astronomers called Jennison and Dasgupta, and they actually used one of these early interferometers with two aerials, and they gradually moved them apart by up to several kilometres, and they studied the structure of Cygnus A. And what they found was that as they moved them apart, so they were effectively able to zoom in and zoom into Cygnus A, this sort of bright spot of radio emission broke up into two spots. And when they measured the separation of these two spots of bright radio emission, they found that they were positioned outside either side of the optical, of the visible light source in this position. So this was really weird at the time. It was like, oh, we've got this optical object, this seen in visible light, probably a galaxy, a sort of fairly extended object, not a point-like thing like a star. But the radio waves turn out to be coming from two spots either side of it, well outside the visible galaxy. Now, we now know, of course, that what's happening is deep in the heart of Cygnus A. This is a radio galaxy, an active galaxy, where there's a supermassive black hole. And as stuff sort of falls in towards that black hole, it sort of swirls around. It forms what we call an accretion disk. So a disk that's sort of swirling around, stuff sort of moves through that, gas moves through that, and eventually disappears into the black hole. But somehow, and it's an effect that's not particularly well understood, it's a combination of the angular momentum, the spin of the stuff as it falls in, and the magnetic field that's threading through it. That winding up effect results in jets of particles that shoot out in opposite directions, sort of perpendicular to the plane of this accretion disk. These jets, this is outside the event horizon, so there's no problem as far as things escaping from a black hole. This is before this stuff's passed into the event horizon. These jets shoot right out of the heart of this galaxy, beyond the visible galaxy, beyond the stars, and where these thin jets of material moving at almost the speed of light crash into the intergalactic medium, the stuff between the galaxies around this particular galaxy, they're slowed down, just like, you know, firing a hose pipe, a jet of water into a sand pit. You sort of the water's slowed down in this big splash. Basically, a lot of the kinetic energy of the jet is turned into thermal energy, produces the acceleration of particles, which leads to a lot of radio emission. So you've basically got these two bright spots either side where these two oppositely directed jets are crashing into the intergalactic medium around the galaxy. And the final question this week is from Martin Webb. And actually, he sent this in a little while ago, and he says, I was wondering, is there any evidence that the speed of light in a vacuum, approximately 299,792,458 meters per second, so that's 299,792,458 meters per second, is there any evidence that that speed could be exceeded? Or will faster than light travel always remain in the realm of science fiction? Now, as I say, actually, Martin sent this in a few months ago. So this was before the announcement just a few weeks ago of the possibility that neutrinos were travelling faster than the speed of light. So this was this result that came out of some scientists in Italy who were measuring the speed of neutrinos that were being produced in CERN and then being detected in a neutrino laboratory in Italy. And they'd found this result that these neutrinos seem to actually be travelling faster than the speed of light. Now, you know, we all know that really things ought not to be travelling faster than the speed of light. That's a tenet of physics that's been around now ever since Einstein's special theory of relativity back in the early 1900s. So really we think that there's something going to be wrong with this experiment. There's some measurement that's wrong. Perhaps actually they've not measured the distance between the source of these neutrinos and the point at which they're measuring their arrival in Italy. Maybe that distance has not been measured accurately enough, and that's why they've got the speed wrong when they measure the time difference. Or maybe there's some reason why the time difference isn't measured properly. It turns out that the speed of the neutrinos that they measure is something like 7 kilometers per second faster than the speed of light, which is about 300,000 kilometers per second. So if you can imagine 7 kilometers per second in 300,000 kilometers per second. That's quite a significant difference. So it's maybe a bit surprising if we hadn't noticed this before. But anyway, you know, very interesting, and interesting in terms of the application of science and how we do experiments. And perhaps one thing that's worth mentioning in terms of astronomy is how this relates to observations of neutrinos arriving from outer space. And in particular, the neutrinos that arrive from the supernova that was spotted in 1987. It's called Supernova 1987A. And actually, this was the first conference that I ever went to as a research student. Back in 1987, there was the first conference about this was in Munich, in Garching. And I remember this whole thing very well. And one of the great things about Supernova 1987A is it's the nearest supernova to ourselves for hundreds and hundreds of years, and so was incredibly well studied. And one of the great results from it was that neutrinos were detected at three different observatories. A little burst of about, in total, about 20-odd antineutrinos were detected at three different observatories, and they arrived about just several hours, about 3 hours, before the visible light was spotted from this supernova. This was visible as a bright star in the sky, just go out at night in the Large Magellanic Cloud, visible in the southern hemisphere, spotted independently by several astronomers on one particular night. And what happens with the neutrinos is that it was a prediction, really, of the theory of the massive star collapsing, resulting in this supernova explosion. So, in fact, the inner parts of the star collapse in on themselves, creating a neutron star, some of which we observe as pulsars later. And the outer parts of the star explode outwards and create these big supernova remnants, like, for example, the Crab Nebula. Now, actually, when that neutron star is formed, one of the predictions is that in that collapse, you would get a burst of neutrinos. Now, these neutrinos actually stream really easily through the body of the star because they're actually really hard to detect. They only interact very weakly with matter. So, you know, they really don't interact at all with the body of the star. They stream out at very high speeds, and they arrive at the Earth. And the light, the visible light from the star actually only sets off when the shock wave resulting from the collapse of this dense neutron star at the center of the star, when that shock wave eventually reaches the surface of the star, then the surface of the star can brighten, can expand and brighten, and that's when the visible light sets off from the supernova. So depending on, you know, the details of the calculation, the difference in time between the collapse of the central part of the star and the shock wave reaching the edge, if that difference in time is several hours, that explains why the neutrinos arrive several hours before the visible light arrives. Now, actually, there were 20-odd of these things detected, but because they're so weakly interacting, there were billions of these things arrive from supernova 1987A, passing through every single square centimetre of our detectors and even of us, our bodies, at the distance of the Earth's, but we only managed to actually detect a few tens of them. Now, the reason that's relevant to this question as to whether things travel faster than the speed of light is because the distance to supernova 1987A is fairly well known from observations of a ring of pre-existing matter that was probably ejected from the star that exploded sometime before the explosion. And that tells us the distance is about 168,000 light years. In other words, the light took about 168,000 years to get here. So if the neutrinos were travelling faster than light by, you know, this factor, 7 kilometres per second faster compared to 300,000 kilometres per second for the light, they'd have actually arrived about 4 years earlier. The light would have taken 168,000 years to get here, but the neutrinos travelling a bit faster would have arrived about 4 years earlier. And we, of course, saw them arrive just a few hours earlier. So that would really be evidence against the fact that these neutrinos really are travelling faster than the speed of light. Now, there are ways you might get out of this, and it's true to say that the types of neutrinos detected in these two experiments, the supernova experiment and the CERN Italian experiment, are different. In one case, there are different types of neutrinos which have different energies, and I guess you could argue that the way in which they travel may well be different. But it perhaps seems a bit unlikely that all this would lead to a burst of detection of neutrinos significantly above the background level just a few hours before this supernova appeared in the visible sky. Seems a bit of a coincidence. So actually, that is an interesting result, though, that Martin actually happened to have sent us a question about this exceeding the speed of light just a little while before actually this result came out about neutrinos. Worth watching that one, and worth seeing what comes in about the design of experiments and what it might be that explains that result in the end.